I'm going to get started right away because we have 25 chapters of Genesis to get through. So if you have your note packet there, it's more like a book packet. It's got 31 pages and about 13,000 words. So we'll see how far we get. Pastor Dave is going to be preaching or teaching this class next week. So I might have a nice stopping point. We'll see where we are with our time when we get there. But in the year of our Lord, 1993, there was a movie that came out. And it came out on June 11th. I was the ripe old age of 9 days. And it's an excellent movie. It's probably one of the classic 90s movies, Jurassic Park, right? Yeah. And in Jurassic Park, the park shuts down. There's this hacking thing that goes on with the computer system. And Samuel L. Jackson, the IT guy, is over there smoking a cigarette, mumbling through his mouth about how bad everything is, right? And they go with the plan to shut everything down, shut their computer system down. And he utters the greatest one-liner of that movie, "Hold on to your butts." So that's what we're going to do. Hold on to your butts. We're going to go through this as fast but as thorough as we can. So we're going to start off with Genesis 25:19. Sean missed the first, or didn't get through the first part of Genesis 25 there. So go back and read his notes on the death of Abraham and the line of Ishmael or the genealogy of Ishmael. But we're going to start in verse 19. But before I get there, in this section, Moses is going to show us that God built the foundation of his relationship with, built on his foundation with his relationship with Abraham through Isaac and Jacob. God's going to demonstrate to the nation of Israel, who are the first recipients of this book, he's going to demonstrate to them that he is present with his people and that he fights for his people. God is present. He's with them and he fights for them. Moses makes this point by significantly increasing the preposition with in this section of Genesis to show that God is present with Isaac and Jacob. So if you have somebody who highlights their Bibles, every time you're reading along with me, highlight the word with or circle the word with because it's going to pop up a lot. So that brings us to verse 21. Here we see the birth of the twins. Just like in chapter 25, we find Rebecca, she's barren, right? Just like Sarah, she is barren, and this pattern of barrenness is established in the Bible, continues on. God miraculously opens that which cannot be opened. He responds to Rebecca's barrenness and God's promise of offspring. Notice what Isaac does. Verse 21, and Isaac entreated Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and Yahweh was moved by his entreaty, so Rebecca, his wife, conceived. Here we see that unlike his father, Isaac did not devise some scheme to continue the promise by marrying one of Rebekah's servants. The first thing he does when his wife is barren is pray. God opened Rebekah's womb, and then she conceived of twins. Moses records that the twins wrestled in a room, and this caused Rebekah some concern. So what does she do? She prays. Verse 22, but the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of Yahweh, and Yahweh said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. See how God sovereignly sets the destiny of her children and their future offspring before the birth even happens. This was done before either of them was born, before either of them committed any act of sin or righteousness. It was God's sovereign plan that the older should serve the younger. And the Apostle Paul records in Romans when arguing for God's sovereign unconditional election. And not only this, but there was Rebecca also, when she was had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For through the twins were not yet born, though the twins were not yet born, and had not done anything good or bad, so that the purpose of God according to his choice would stand. Not because of works, because of him who calls it, was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. Just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. What shall we say then? Is there any unrighteousness with God? May it never be. Right? So God is choosing who he will choose. He says to Moses at the end of that chapter, I will have mercy on who I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. He's having mercy and compassion and choosing Jacob before Jacob does anything good or bad. And as we're going to see, Jacob does a whole lot of bad. Does a whole lot of bad. So this theological truth is important to keep in the back of our minds as we continue through the life of Jacob. And 20 years after Isaac and Rebekah pray to God, or Isaac prays to God, and she She gives birth to her boys. So think of that. Isaac prays to God to open a womb. 20 years later, the kids are born. And it says that the first one came forth red. That's why he's called Esau. He was hairy as well. So he's this red, hairy boy. They named him Esau. And afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, so that his name was called Jacob. Esau grew up to be a skillful hunter, a man of the field, and this made his father love him. Jacob was a peaceful man living in the tents with his mama. He was a mama's boy. It's important to comment on the meaning of Jacob's name. Translated, it means one who grabs the heel, but more literally, it means supplanter, which I had to look that up in the dictionary because that's not a word I use. Supplanter, according to the dictionary, is somebody who supersedes another, especially by force, scheme, or treachery. He's a schemer. He's a deceiver. And this is exactly what we see with the character of Jacob as time goes on. As the twins grew, God's sovereign plan for their lives begins to take shape, and their parents each choose a favorite son. Like I said, Isaac chooses the one who's always outside hunting, Esau, and his wife, Rebecca, chooses the one who's always inside, Jacob. And that brings us to verse 25, where we see in the early years, this younger brother is this deceiver. He's this schemer. So Jacob cooks some stew. His brother comes in from a hunt, and his brother is famished. He says, please give me a swallow from that red stuff, the red stuff, for I'm famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom, right? Which is another phrase for red. But Jacob says, first, what you have to do is sell me your birthright, which is this not just a nice monetary inheritance. The birthright of Isaac was the right to inherit the covenant promises of God that he inherited from his father Abraham. And what this text shows us is that Esau has no interest in this birthright. He'd rather have some stew. He sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. He despised this birthright, right? And we'll see that come into more importance later. In chapter 26, we see this life of Isaac. Isaac has a very short section in Scripture where we just see his life and how he, see his character and how he lived. It's just one chapter, whereas compared to Abraham, he gets all these chapters. Jacob gets all these chapters. Joseph gets all these chapters. Isaac gets one. And it's really important to see that Isaac is growing in his faith beyond what his father had, but also struggles with the same things. He is sinful, right? And so he's not perfect. And we see in verses 1 through 2 that there's a famine in the land. And instead of fleeing down to Egypt like his father Abraham did, he stays in the promised land. And God appears to him and commands him to stay. In verse 3, sojourn in this land and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your seed I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham, and I'll multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and I'll give you seed all these lands, and by your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So there is a repetition of the Abrahamic promises. Those promises, that covenant didn't die with Abraham, it moved on to Isaac. And Isaac here is having faith in that promise and that command by staying in the promised land. We see that Isaac's not immune, though, to falling into the same temptations his father did. Just as Abraham did with Sarah, his wife Isaac lies to Abimelech, the Philistine, and out of self-preservation that his beautiful wife is not his wife, but his sister. But somebody caught them doing something that marital people do and realized either this is a weird family or she's not your wife. And God also protects Abimelech and reveals to him that Isaac is not his wife, right? Remembering God's impending judgment from his past encounter with Abraham and Sarah, Abimelech says to Isaac, get out of here. Like, this is not good. I don't want anything to do with your wife. Isaac then settles in the land of Abimelech, becomes incredibly blessed by Yahweh, reaping 100 more times than what he sows. He becomes so rich that his flocks grow so vast that Abimelech tells him to leave. Like I was saying, he tells him to get out of here. He's outgrowing Abimelech and the Philistines. And as his father did before him, Isaac establishes himself officially in the land by digging wells. This is the cool thing about this chapter. If you go back and read it, he digs wells, and then people come and take his wells, and then he's like, okay, I'm just going to dig another hole in the desert, and guess what? Water comes up. He just digs another hole in the desert. Water comes up. He is staying in the land. God is blessing him. He's seeing that blessing, right? And he ends up settling in the land of Beersheba, where Abraham first dug his well in Canaan. It's there that verse 24, Yahweh appeared to him that night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your seed for the sake of my servant Abraham. once more at the very end of this narrative on Isaac's life, God appears and promises Isaac blessing and his presence. He's with Isaac. Which then brings us to Jacob's second scheme, Jacob's second deception. As the life of Isaac ends, he decides that he wants to give his paternal blessing to Esau. And Isaac desires that Esau and his descendants carry on the family heritage, and he does this despite the promise that God gave to Rebekah. Surely she shared that prophecy, that dream that God shared with him, but he's trying to take things into his own hands, just like Abraham tried to do with Ishmael, right? And he sends Esau out to go on a hunt to make this meal or prepare this food for this covenant ceremony. But Rebekah hears of her scheme. And if you guys remember last week with Rebekah and the well running back and forth, Rebekah is fast. She's super fast. She's industrious. She's efficient. Like you say in sports, you can't teach speed. And she and Rebekah have a better plan. They devise this plan to fool their husband by causing Jacob to be covered in this hairy wool. And Isaac can't really see because he's getting old. So they come up to him and they have the smell of Isaac he's wearing, or the smell of Esau he's wearing his clothes. He's got the feel of Esau. He's got hair on his arms. And this foolproof plan is going to work out until he has to open his mouth, right? And he sounds like Esau. Or he sounds like Jacob instead of Esau. But in the end, Isaac is fooled. He gives the blessing to Jacob. And listen to the all too true words of Jacob when their plan was busted. He says this, Isaac said to his son, verse 27, 20. How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? He's talking about finding the food and cooking it up for a meal. Isaac's like, how did you do it? And Isaac says this, Jacob says this, because Yahweh your God caused it to happen to me. God caused Isaac to be convinced he was blessing Esau. What will be seen in the rest of Jacob's life is that he will play many schemes. Most of the schemes that Jacob plans are going to be terrible, foolhardy. However, God will providentially redeem all of them. Jacob's schemes, but God redeems. That's kind of the theme or the mantra of Jacob's life. Jacob's schemes, God redeems. After Isaac blesses Jacob, Esau comes home with the meal and he's too late, right? And Isaac discovers he's deceived. He's filled with anger. However, there's no going back. Isaac blessed Jacob and he shall be blessed. Upon hearing this, Esau is filled with murderous hate. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. So this should remind you of another brother, right? Cain, seeking to kill Abel, right? The righteous brother. Even though Jacob's not the righteous brother here, we're starting to see that delineation between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Esau is acting like that Cain, that seed of the serpent. He's wanting to kill Jacob. This plot to kill Jacob comes to Rebekah. She then sends her son to flee, sends her to her brother Laban. The author of Hebrews looks back on this moment and gives us instruction on the dangers of bitterness and unrepentance. Right, thinking about Esau and his heart towards his brother. Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord, seeing to it that none of you falls short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. That also there be no sexually immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it with tears, right? He has no desire to accept God's blessing on his brother and seek to support and care for his brother and serve him. Instead, he wants to kill him. He's filled with bitterness and he wants to destroy his brother, right? So before Jacob leaves, his father calls for him and officially blesses him with the full knowledge that he is Jacob. Like Abraham once did before him, Isaac commands his son not to marry a daughter of the Canaanites, but instead take a wife for his mother's relative. He says this at the end of that blessing, 28 verse 3, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may become an assembly of peoples. So then Jacob is sent out of the land in order to preserve his life and the promised seed. That brings us to chapter 28. Verses 10 through 22, at the opening of Jacob's journey, he's all alone and he sets up his camp in a place near Haran. And it's here that he had this famous dream. Behold, a ladder stood on the earth, 28:12, with its top touching heaven, and behold, the angels of God were descending and ascending and descending on it. So we have this picture of a ladder to heaven with angels going up and down. And at the very top of this ladder, who do we see? Verse 13. Behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you, to your seed, and your seed will also be with like the dust of the earth. There's a callback to the promise made to Abraham. And you will spread out the west to the west and the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. And I'll bring you back to this land, for I will not forsake you until I have done what I have promised you. So Jacob's about to leave the land. He's leaving the promised land, and God's showing up. He says, even though you're not going to be in this promised land, I'm going to be with you, right? He's going to cause him to return. He's going to cause his family to inherit this land. He's going to multiply him like the sands of the sea. He's going to multiply him like the dust of the earth, right? So like Abraham and Isaac before him, God speaks to Jacob and promises to carry out the covenant he made to Abraham and Isaac. He's faithful from generation to generation to generation. That's the message there. I am faithful and I'm going to be with you. God promises that he's going to be with him, keep him wherever he goes, bring him back to the land. And after this dream, Jacob awakens and names this place Bethel, which means the house or the dwelling place of God. However, after this, Jacob decides to make a vow of his own. He can't stop himself from scheming. He says, okay, God, I like those promises, but I'll let you be my God as long as you meet a couple of my conditions. Verse 20, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on his journey, this journey on which I'm going, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in peace, then Yahweh will be my God. So Jacob's not all the way on board. He doesn't understand that God's promises are sure, that he is faithful from generation to generation. He ignored that part where God's promising the things he promised to Abraham, that he showed to Abraham through 75 years or however many decades that took for Abraham to receive the promise and the blessing of Isaac. He ignored all the things that God has done for his forefathers and even in his own life and says, okay, God, I'll let you be my God if you feed me, clothe me, and come keep me safe, even though God promised to do those very things. Jacob thinks he can negotiate a deal with God, right? But before we move on, I want to make a biblical theological connection, a biblical theology connection. And this is kind of taking a broader view of the whole Bible and seeing some themes and major points that connect to each other. This moment with the ladder going up to heaven connects back and it points forward, right? Thinking back to the events that just came before the calling of Abraham, we saw men come together, try to make for them a name for themselves and build a tower up to heaven, right? They're trying to build their own stairway to heaven, so that they could be like God, that they could take God's authority and rule over themselves, make a name for themselves, right? But here we see the beautiful reality that God is not unreachable. God has to come down to punish those people in Babel. Here he shows Jacob that he's with him, that he is not unreachable. He's not distant. He's the Almighty Creator, the one true God, but he has not kept himself from man. Instead, he is with man. He is caring for them, ministering to them, sending forth his angels down to earth to be with them. What the original readers of Genesis and the generations beyond would see from this is that God has not left us, mankind, in our sins, right? Instead, he descends down to be with us. We'll see this message further fleshed out in the theology of the tabernacle and the temple where God walks with his people, where he dwells with his people in his own house, right? Coming back to the name of Bethel. But this message finds its endpoint not in a place, but in a person. Remember in the Gospel of John how when Jesus first calls his disciples, he alludes to this very passage, John 1:50. Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. Then he said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened up and the angels of God ascending and descending, not on a ladder, but on the Son of Man. Right? In doing so, Jesus is stating that the ladder in Jacob's dream pointed to him. He is the bridge between heaven and earth. He is the mediator between God and man. He is Emmanuel, which means God with us, right? So that brings us to chapter 29, where we see Jacob versus the scheme master. Chapter 29, we see that Jacob has left the land of Canaan, and he enters the land of the sons of the east, where his uncle Laban lives. Upon arriving, he meets this woman, Rachel, at a well, similar to how Isaac Isaac's Abraham's servant meets Rebecca at the well and brings him back to Isaac. He meets Rachel at the well, and it's love at first sight. He is smitten with this beautiful woman. He kisses her on the lips, which is, I don't know, it might be an ancient custom. It might just be Jacob being Jacob. And tells Laban, hey, I want to marry this girl. He tells Laban of his situation with his brother. Laban not just offers his daughter's hand in marriage, he also offers asylum to Jacob. Jacob agrees to work for 7 years for her hand in marriage. And the text says that those 7 years were but a day because he's in love with this girl, right? In doing so, Jacob obeys his father's command not to marry a Canaanite, and the hope of the seed promise in Genesis 3:15 continues on. He's going to get married. Now, Laban is the real schemer, right? He is the one who knows what he's doing. He's like that guy, I don't know the characters because I'm not familiar with the movie, but the head honcho in the Ocean's movies, he's that guy, right? Laban is the real schemer. He sees an opportunity in Jacob. He knows about God's hand of blessing upon Abraham and his family from past encounters with Abraham's servant who enriched his family, right? So he devises this treacherous plot in verses 21 through 23. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. It's very bold of him. Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. And Laban gathered all the men of the place, and he made this massive feast. And he says, now it happened in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went in to her. When Jacob woke up, he realized he was sleeping not next to his beautiful wife Rachel, but to her sister Leah. And he's furious, right? Laban, being the grand schemer that he is, offered to allow Jacob to really marry his love, Rachel, for 7 more years of free labor and a secondhand blessing from God. But it doesn't stop there. The last layer to Jacob's plan is to introduce family dysfunction. Look how long he makes Jacob wait to have his wife that he wants, Rachel. Verse 27, fulfill the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for the service which you will serve me for about another 7 years. Just put yourself in the situation. Kind of just step away from the familiarity of this and think about how this family dynamic is shaping out to be. Imagine how bitter and hurt Leah would have been after experiencing such disrespect and disregard from her new husband. He marries her sister a week into their honeymoon. Laban's plan is to create so much dysfunction in Jacob's family that it won't grow. If Jacob's family doesn't grow, then Jacob won't even have enough children to help him shepherd a flock of his own and grow his wealth enough to have to leave Laban's household. Therefore, Laban is able to keep Jacob there and experience God's blessing. And that is his plan. But instead of internal family turmoil leading to minimal marital bliss and subsequently a small family, God blesses Leah with great fertility. She, even though is unloved by her husband, the text actually says that she is hated by her husband, she is fertile, incredibly fertile. And she has 3 sons. They're Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. And then she has a 4th son, and his name is Judah, verse 31, chapter 29:31. And Yahweh saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren, right? Her sister, who was loved, was barren. And she bears his 4th son, Judah, and she says this. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise Yahweh. So those first 3 sons kind of have negative names. They're filled with sorrow and tragedy. Their names have this meaning of sorrow and tragedy because she's unloved and hated by her husband. But here with the birth of Judah, whose name means praise, she says, this time I will praise Yahweh. And there's a lesson here. And what it means for God to be with us, right? It's not just that he's protecting us. It's not that he's providing for us in this kind of far off way. He sees our pain, right? He sees when human relationships are breaking down and how that's causing strife and tragedy and dysfunction, right? He sees struggle. He loves the unloved Leah, and he compassionately redeems her situation of rejection by blessing her. This causes Rachel, though, to become jealous, even more jealous of her sister. Verse 31, then Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children. So she became jealous of her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. And Jacob's like, I'm not God. I can't do anything here. Since she's barren, she gives her servant Bilhah to Jacob as a wife. Bilhah bears Jacob two sons, and it seems that Leah stops bearing children as well, so she doesn't want to get caught behind. She left behind, so she gives her servant Zilpah to be Jacob's fourth wife. Zilpah bears Jacob two more sons, but then God opens Leah's womb once more and gives her two more sons and a daughter. How many of you knew that Jacob had a daughter? Right? That's good. Jacob didn't just have 12 kids. He also had a daughter, and she's really important. God looked upon Rachel's barrenness then, after all of this, and he causes her to conceive too. Verse 22 through 23, then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach, right? God is said to remember Rachel. That means doesn't mean he forgot about Rachel. It means he set his mind, his intent on caring for specifically Rachel in that moment. This is the first time this phrase of God remembering an individual is seen after it was first used with Noah, right? God remembered that Noah was there and caused the flood to end and caused Noah to be able to leave the ark, right? God is seeing this struggle with Rachel and he remembers her, right? This is an intent from God to care for her. In this twisted story of a messed up family dynamics and broken marriages, we see God simultaneously defeat the scheme of Laban, fulfill his covenant promises to Jacob, and demonstrate compassion for the unloved. Jacob and Laban scheme, but God redeems. Eventually, Jacob decides that it's time for him to return to his own country, so he goes to Laban and he's like, hey, I'm out of here. I gotta go. And Laban's like, whoa. You can't go just yet. Let me have you stay here for just a little while and we'll bring up a flock of your own, right? We'll give you something to take with you, some flock, some sheep to take with you. Since Jacob, let's see here. Verse 27, this is the reason why he doesn't say, I'll let you go. Laban said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, stay with me. I've interpreted an omen that Yahweh has blessed me on your account. So he doesn't want to lose the blessing of Yahweh. Jacob agrees on this one condition that he can get some sheep from Laban to start a flock of his own, made up of the blemished sheep of Laban's flock. And Laban agrees to these terms and then comes up with this scheme to send all of his blemished sheep with his son out to pasture. So Jacob comes to Laban's flock and all there is white sheep, right? And so he has essentially nothing. Not to be out-schemed, Jacob develops a scheme of his own based on an ancient myth. During the mating season, he has a strong sheep in Laban's flock to mate in front of these poplar and almond sticks that are striped and speckled, right? There's a thought that was even made fun of back then that if you caused animals to mate in front of certain colored sticks, they would come out, the babies would come out, those colors. This scheme is filled with foolish superstition. It's a faith not in God to provide, to be with him, but in a myth. But behind Jacob's scheme, God works through the genetics of conception to cause Jacob's plan to succeed. His flock grows abundantly, as well as his household and his servants and other animals. So God gives him the flock. He redeems his silly plan. And then Jacob decides to bounce. He decides to leave in chapter 31 without talking to Laban, which in that time, those who were under a certain person's household were considered that person's kids, even though Jacob's kids were his kids. They were Laban's grandkids and they were living under his household. So the code of that day, the law of that day required Jacob to say, get permission from Laban to leave. And he tries to do that the chapter before. Laban's like, no, let's not do that. Stay with me. So Jacob decides, hey, I'm just gonna leave, right? All of Laban and his sons and his brothers are out at this feast where they're shearing their sheep, which is a festival time filled with much drinking and debauchery. So this is the perfect time for Jacob to leave, except for the one flaw in his plan. He's traveling with a bunch of women and children. So Laban comes home and he sees everything. Everybody's gone, including his household's gods, which makes him really mad because his idols are gone. So he can't be blessed by his idols and by Jacob and his God. So he chases after them. But before he gets there, God appears to Laban and he warns him to leave Jacob alone. Don't speak any good or bad to him, right? And after hearing this message from God, Laban spares Jacob's life. Jacob should have died. He kidnapped Laban's kids. He took Laban's daughters or grandkids, and the punishment for kidnapping is death. Right? He didn't receive Laban's blessing to leave, but God intervenes on that scenario and spares Jacob. And when Jacob recognizes God's intervention, he makes this declaration in verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the dread of Isaac, had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered the decision last night. So Jacob realizes, hey, God redeemed the situation. If he didn't see it, either I'd be dead or going home without my family, without all my flock. But he gets to have everything, right? And that, as he's leaving, he comes to Esau, right? That's in chapter 32, Jacob and Esau, round two. After this final encounter with Laban, God sends angels to meet with Jacob. Jacob's afraid, right? He sees that Esau's coming. Esau wanted to kill him 20 years ago, right? And that desire to kill his brother only festered over those 20 years. That's what Jacob's assuming. Grudges don't go away. They grow usually, right? And Genesis 32, 1 through 2, we see this. Now Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him. Then Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named the place Mahanaim. Jacob's camp, he realizes, is God's camp. He's encamped with Jacob. However, after this sweet reminder of God, of those angels coming down on that ladder to protect him, Jacob is filled with great distress and fear because his brother Esau is coming with 400 men to meet him. Instead of trusting God, who had just sent two angels to him for reassurance and protection, Jacob begins to scheme. At first, he decides to split his camp in two, which, is that a good or bad military strategy? Bad, right? You go from having full protection to half the protection, right? And after he makes this plan, he realizes his folly and decides to pray. Verse 9, and Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Yahweh, who said to me, return to your land and to your kin, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the truth which you have shown to your slave. For with my staff only I cross this Jordan, and now I've become two camps. Deliver me, I pray. Right? He's seeking God's help. He's saying, deliver me. He asks for this deliverance from Esau based on not his own works, his own schemes, but on the loving kindness and the faithfulness that God has shown to Abraham and Isaac and to himself. Instead of bartering with God, he is praying for his aid because of God's character, based on God's character. He's trusting that God will be faithful to his promises that he made to him to return to the land and prosper him. This is good, right? This is a kind of a check-in on Jacob's journey, and he's doing well in this moment, right? But sadly, just as we thought Jacob might be done with scheming and just trust God, he decides to send Esau a bribe of 500 livestock, right, in exchange for a safe passage. This is worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And he's like, here, let me give this gift to you, which the phrase gift is also birthright, but it's also kind of like a bribe. So he's trying to make restitution. He's trying to earn Esau's favor, and he's trying to do everything he can in his own power to turn Esau away. He decides to go ahead with his plan to split up his family for the rest of the camp and place them on one side of a river. So he takes all of his servants and his flock, and most of these servants are probably men who could probably fight in a battle, and then he takes all of his women and children and puts them on another side of the river, right? So if he could cross that river easily with women and children, what could Esau do? Cross that river just as easily, right? Dumb plan. He can't stop his scheming. After this, he has a dream, right? He goes to sleep, and it's not a dream. It's a real thing that happened. He has this wrestling match with God, verse 24 through 26. Then Jacob was left alone, and this man shows up. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of dawn, and he saw that he had not prevailed against him, so he touched the socket of his thigh. And so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he was wrestling with him. Then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. This whole wrestling match was really a method of teaching Jacob about the futility of scheming and how God was really the one who gained victory for Jacob. Imagine you have I was 5 years older than my brother, right? And I would regularly wrestle and play with him, and I would kind of let him think we were playing so that the wrestling match would last longer than 20 seconds, right? So I would like lay on my stomach and let him climb on my back and like pull my head, or, you know, I would just let him think he was winning. Right? That's what God is doing here. He's letting Jacob think he was winning all night, waiting for Jacob to realize, hey, this guy is not somebody I can wrestle to the ground. I should give up. And Jacob's thinking, hey, I'm almost beating him, right? And they fight for literally hours. And God's like, okay, I'm just going to end this now. He touches Jacob's hip, right? Causes Jacob in an instant to be the loser in this match, dislocating his hip. causing him to realize that he's fighting not with just an ordinary man, but with God. Jacob schemed to allow God to be his God at Bethel, even though God had already promised his presence. He schemed to take Laban's flock, but God is the one who blessed him with speckled sheep. He schemed to run away from Laban, but God came to Laban in a dream to protect Jacob. And even after God quickly ends the match by dislocating Jacob's hip with a mere touch, he schemes to wrestle a blessing from God by taking hold and refusing to let him go. God then turns from wrestling to interrogation. Verse 27, so he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name should no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." God asks him his name, and he replies that it is Jacob, heel catcher, supplanter, deceiver, schemer. For all his life, his name has been attached to the stigma of him catching his brother's heel, stealing his brother's birthright. And once Jacob confesses his name, God renames him, much like he did with Abraham earlier, from Abram to Abraham. God renames Jacob to become Israel, which has two meanings. One who strives or fights with God, or if you change around where you put the emphasis, God strives or fights for you, right? And the latter meaning makes the most sense in the context of Jacob's life. He's always tried to fight. He's always tried to strive. He's always tried to scheme. But in renaming Jacob to Israel, God is declaring to him, "I'm fighting for you." So Jacob named this place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face." He realizes who this man is. "Yet my life has been delivered." In naming this place, we begin to see a change in Jacob. He does not name the place for the fight that occurred. He named it with emphasis on the God he saw. And God shielded him from death, from seeing his presence, seeing his face, and dying. He recognizes that he should have died in the wrestling match with the living God, but God preserved him. Earlier in verse 12, Jacob prayed that God would preserve him, deliver him from Esau. Now he recognizes that his life has been preserved, not from Esau, but from God, by God. This death should have come from seeing God, but he saved him, he preserved him. However, sadly, Jacob's not done with his schemes. When dawn comes, Esau approaches. We see Jacob divide up his camp once more. Instead of splitting them in two, he sets them in a line. And he makes up this line of his wives and children based on who he loves most. So if you didn't in that family already know where you stood in your dad's eyes, now you get it, right? So the first came the maids of his wives and their four children, and they're placed in the front. So they're the most unloved, the first ones to die if Esau attacks. Lastly, there came his favorite wife, or next came Leah and her six children. They're the next to die. And then lastly came his favorite wife and her son, Joseph, who were placed at the very end of the camp so that they might have some time to run away if Esau attacked. This little event sets up for the rest of Jacob's narrative. On top of being a schemer, Jacob is the head of the most dysfunctional family in the Bible, right? Yet, in a demonstration of his faith in God's protection, Jacob goes ahead of the entire camp to meet Esau. And just as God promised, Esau does not harm him. Like I said earlier, time doesn't make grudges go away. It usually makes them grow. But his grudge went away. Why? God changed his heart, right? And there's a lesson here to be learned about forgiveness and reconciliation, right? We might not see how grudges will go away between brothers who've been wronged, or how there might be some dissension, or, you know, you've lost a relationship. But if God can repair the relationship of Jacob and Esau, surely he can work on the hearts of those who might have a grudge against you, or are unforgiving towards you, or resistant to your desire to reconcile with you. God can change the hearts of men, right? So Jacob finally returns safely to Canaan, settling in Shechem. And just as Abram and Isaac did before him, Jacob demonstrates faith in God's promise of land by purchasing property and building an altar. He calls it El Elohi Israel, which means God is the God of Israel. He's his God, right? God is redeeming the schemer. However, got one last pitfall here. It's the saddest chapter in all of Genesis, Genesis 34. After settling in Shechem amongst the Canaanites, a horrific conflict arises when Jacob's daughter Dinah is raped by the son of the king of Shechem. What is startling is Jacob seems to be unmoved by this crime. He keeps the news to himself and to his sons' return from shepherding their livestock. And when they return, Jacob tells them of the crime against their sister. And they all sit down with the king of Shechem, Hamor. When they meet, Hamor makes Jacob and his sons an offer. "Give me your daughter Dinah for my son, Shechem, and then let your sons intermarry with my daughters. And then name your bride price, and I'll give whatever you want to you in exchange for your daughter's hand in marriage. And instead of demanding the just punishment of death for the crime committed, what does Jacob do? He entertains his offer from Hamor, right? He uses the situation of his daughter being raped to preserve peace and gain wealth. However, Jacob's sons have a different idea in mind. They agree to Hamor's deal, but his sons place one requirement. All the city's men must be circumcised. As you see in 25, this was a deceitful scheme. And this is the scheme of Simeon and Levi, Dinah's blood brothers, right? The daughters of Leah. Simeon and Levi, they cause the whole city to be in pain. And when they were all in pain, all the men are in pain and defenseless, Simeon and Levi go down there and kill every single man in the city. And they kill Hamor and his son, Shechem, and they take their daughter, their sister, back home. This is just tragic, right? They should have only taken the life of Shechem, Hamor's son who raped their sister, because that was justice, true justice in the legal system of that day. That was a crime punishable by death. However, guided by their wrathful vengeance, instead of justice, Simeon and Levi commit what today would be called a war crime. They'd be tried in The Hague for what they did, right? Sadly, what is the most pitiful part of the story is the response of Jacob, verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and strike me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." Who's Jacob thinking of there? Himself. Seven times the first person plural is used there. This whole situation with his daughter being raped makes him only think of himself. Right? It's sad. It's very tragic, right? And the beautiful thing about the Bible is that it's real, right? We don't have this glossy story of the great person Jacob. We have this story of how terrible he is. And guess what? God chose him. God chose Jacob, right? God chooses the most unlikely people, the most unlovely people, the most sinful to make his own, right? And that's the story we can see from Jacob's sin. After this terrible ordeal, God comes to Jacob and commands him to leave Shechem. God's like, this place is not where you're going to prosper. And he says to return to Bethel and settle there. Remember, Bethel is where Jacob first slept after fleeing his father's house to avoid being murdered by Esau. It's where he had that dream of the ladder. And this sparks something within Jacob. He kind of has a wake-up moment. Verse 2. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods which are among you and cleanse yourself and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone." All right? So Jacob recognizes, okay, God is my God. He's the only God we got to serve. Let's get rid of all of our idols. Let's get rid of all of our garments that we use to worship our idols. Change our clothes. Get clean. We need to be holy because we serve a holy God. All right? Verse 5, then they journeyed on, and there was terror from God upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. See, Jacob's biggest fear about the Shechemites is that they would cause him to be, they would attack him, right, if he retaliated for the rape of Dinah. And here he didn't have to do anything. God just caused all the people in all of Canaan to fear him as he traveled to Bethel. Notice that there's no mention of Jacob dividing his camp or scheming or lying about his wives being his sisters to protect his family somehow. He's just trusting God and traveling to Bethel, trusting him to fight for him. When Jacob returns to Bethel, God appears to Jacob once more. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." Thus he called his name Israel, and God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and an assembly of nations shall come from you, and the kings shall come forth from your loins. And the lands which I gave Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land of your seed after you." See how God blessed him and officially renamed him Israel. He named him Israel at that time he wrestled with Jacob at the shore there, but here he's renaming him officially. This is kind of the official process. And he also gives the command that he gave to Adam and to Noah to be fruitful and multiply. In this, we see that Jacob and his sons will bring about the blessings not only of Abraham, but of the blessings of Edenic rest that was lost when Adam sinned and partially restored by Noah after the flood. They were to be a people who carried the line of the seed to redeem creation a people who would produce kings, specifically a king, right? And after this promise from God, Rachel, the wife Jacob loved, bore his last son. However, it ends in tragedy. She dies in childbirth after giving birth to Benjamin. It's essential to see that this story at Bethel forms a bookend, inclusio in the life and story of Jacob. The remaining narrative of Genesis then shifts from Jacob onto his sons, those who would be kings, right? The question then arises, who out of Jacob's 12 sons will carry on the lineage of the seed of Genesis 3:15? It ends with Jacob finally returning home to his father Isaac. And before Isaac's death, just as Abraham was buried by Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau meet together to bury their father next to Abraham and Sarah in Hebron. And then this chapter 36, we see the offspring of Esau. It's another genealogy here of Esau. After burying their father, Esau and Jacob part ways, with Esau settling east of the promised land. This land became known as Edom, and Edom's descendants became known as Edomites or Idumeans. It is essential to remember that throughout biblical history, from this point forward, there's going to be generational strife between the offspring of Jacob and the offspring of Esau. This strife culminates with the plot of King Herod the Great, the Idumean, the Edomite, attempting to murder the infant Christ, and then Herod Antipas participating in the trial to execute Christ on the cross, right? So there's going to be this continual strife culminating in Christ. And that brings us to our next main part. And we are doing okay. We got 30 minutes. We might not get through all of this, but it's too early to call it quits. So bear with me. Let's see if we can get through this. This is my favorite part of Genesis. I love this section, the genealogy of Jacob, right? So these sections in Genesis are named by the genealogy of that person. This is the genealogy of Jacob, even though it's the story of Jacob's sons. Genesis 17, God promised Abraham that kings and princes would come from his offspring. We just saw this was reiterated to Jacob at Bethel, indicating that the line of Abraham would be a royal line. The narrative now shifts focus to Abraham's grandsons, the 12 sons of Jacob. And the question that this section answers is which of Jacob's 12 sons, will be the heir of the royal lineage of the seed. In answering this question, God will also demonstrate to the nation of Israel another aspect of their core value as a nation. Previously, God has shown that his people must be people of faith, like Abraham and Isaac, in light of the Abrahamic covenant. Through Isaac and Jacob, he who is renamed Israel, he's demonstrated that he is a God who is present with his people, and that he is a God who fights for his people. But how does God fight? The main point of this section is to demonstrate that God fights to turn evil to good for his chosen nation. And Israel is to be a nation that has faith in this God who redeems evil to good, right? So Jacob's favorite son, chapter 37. I pick up the story with the focus on his son from his favorite wife, Rachel, Joseph. And remember that Rachel, like Sarah and Rebecca before her, was barren until God remembered her womb so that she bore Joseph. So we're getting this hint from Moses that just this Joseph guy is going to be a big deal, even before he was born, with his barrenness motif. And look at verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back an evil report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him in peace. Contrary to popular thought from Sunday school days of old, Joseph is not this cute little innocent child, right? He's 17 years old. If you guys have teenagers, think about a teenager who's about to be an adult, right? That's Joseph. He's pretty much an adult. And at this young age, he's not only his father's favorite, but he's given this very colored tunic, which is really a long sleeve shirt made of fine material, used not to designate a shepherd, but to designate royalty. Jacob intends for everyone to see Joseph as his royal heir. Jacob also gives Joseph authority over the sons of Jacob gives Joseph authority over his least favorite wives, the sons of his least favorite wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. And one day, he gives this bad report about them. This inspires great animosity and hate between Joseph and his brothers. They want to do what Esau wanted to do. They want to kill him, right, from the very beginning. Soon after this bad report, Joseph then decides to tell his brothers about two separate dreams in which his family bowed down before him. After hearing this dream, Joseph and his brothers are even more angry, right? Genesis 37:8, then his brothers said to them, "Are you really going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. If you go back and read the account of those dreams, notice how often, though, Joseph says, "Behold." It's like, "Hey, guys, look at this. Look at this. Look at this. I'm going to, look at this, rule over you. You're going to bow down to me." And that's kind of arrogant, right? We're going to see this arrogance and this when he interprets dreams change as Joseph's life goes on. That's an important note I took out and I wanted to put back in. The brothers' evil plot. So they hate him. They want to kill him. Moses then moves us forward to a day when the mood in Joseph's family, or in Israel's family, goes from tense irritation to murderous hatred. Joseph, who for some reason didn't have to go out and care for the flock with his brothers, is sent to supervise them once more. When he begins to approach them, they said to one another, verse 19 of chapter 37, "Here comes this dreamer. So now come, let us kill him. Cast him into one of those pits. And we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." They, like Esau and Cain before them, are filled with a desire to murder their brother. However, Reuben, the oldest brother, overrides this plan with a scheme of his own. Remember, Reuben is the firstborn of Leah. He's the oldest. He's the one who thinks he should deserve Jacob's blessing. He compels his brothers to spare Joseph's life and instead throw him into the pit and keep him there for a while. And so that he could come back later and save Joseph and earn his father's good favor. Reuben was desperate to regain the blessing of the firstborn son. In chapter 35, I skipped over this too, Reuben asserted his dominance as the oldest brother by engaging in an ancient Near Eastern practice of taking his father's concubines and sleeping with them, right? So he took Jacob's wives, his servant wives, and he slept with them, demonstrating that he is the new head of the house, right? And that obviously didn't go over smoothly with Jacob. Reuben's kind of out of favor. And so he comes up with this plan to save Israel, Jacob's favorite son, Joseph. But his scheme fails when he leaves his brothers alone with his captive, right? Reuben's younger brother, Judah, comes up with a plan of his own. He doesn't want to kill his brother. He wants to make a killing off of his brother. Verse 26, Judah said to his brothers, "What gain is it that we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up, lifted Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. It's here that we start to see who the real leader of the brothers is. After Judah and his brothers sell Joseph, they take his robe, and they soak it in blood so that they might deceive their father into thinking that Joseph was killed by a fierce animal, right? And in this we see providential justice be served. How did Jacob fool his father? With a piece of clothing, some goat skin. How is he fooled by his sons? With goat's blood, a piece of clothing, right? Christ's connection point. In this instance, we see that Joseph is set up as a type of Christ. He, like Joseph, was sent by his father to his kinsmen, who then devised a plot to murder him. When they saw Joseph approaching, they said to themselves, "Come, let us kill him." This phrase occurs one more time in the Bible, and it's in the parable of Jesus of the vineyard owner's son. Here the owner of the vineyard sends his sons to deal with the wicked vine growers, and Matthew records Jesus' words, "But when the vine growers saw the son, they said among themselves, 'This is the heir, come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance.'" So Jesus is foretelling of the death that he's going to experience, the betrayal of his own people. Moreover, Joseph's brother Judah sells him for a few silver coins. Prophet Zechariah alludes back to this moment when he foretells of Israel's rejection of their Messiah in Zechariah 11 and fulfilled by one of the 12 disciples, Judas, who shares the same name as Judah, betrays the Lord for 30 pieces of silver. Jacob's sinful son, chapter 38. This is the second darkest chapter in Genesis. After this final note on Joseph's whereabouts in Egypt, the text shifts its focus on this leader, Judah. His wickedness comes into focus immediately. The text of verse 1 states that at that same time that Joseph is being sold into Egypt, Judah decides to leave his family and goes down to Canaan, the Canaanites. This going down is more than moving from a high place to a valley. So highlight that or underline it in your Bibles. He goes down. It is a mirror of his spiritual condition. He's leaving the household of God and he's going down to the Canaanites. Well, among the Canaanites, Judah saw a woman and took her. Verse 2. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Notice how the language of marital intimacy is missing here. Judah did not know his wife. He simply satisfied the lust of his eyes by taking this Canaanite woman. This language is used to describe the action of Eve in the garden, seeing that the fruit was good and taking it. It is also used of the wicked son of Cain, Lamech, who took his two wives after seeing them. And it's also used of Shechem, the one who raped Judah's half-sister Dinah, saw Dinah and took her, right? So this is a terrible action. It might even imply some forceful marriage here. Beyond this example of wicked, uncontrolled lust, Judah was forsaking the pattern set forth by his fathers and grandfathers. He wasn't supposed to marry a Canaanite. Judah's wicked and evil. He has no love for his brothers, no regard for his family, his father's wishes, or the covenant of God. He's a man who lives only to satisfy his wicked desires. After some time passed, Judah receives three sons, and in verse 6, we see him find a wife for his first son, Ur. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of Yahweh, so Yahweh put him to death. We don't know what he did, but it must have been so despicable because this is the first time in all the Bible that God explicitly kills someone for their sins. In that culture, if a man dies and leaves behind a widow, his wife is then to remarry the dead man's brother. Now, if the dead man's brother and wife have a son, that son will become their new firstborn heir of the family. This is called levirate marriage. We see this happen with Ruth and Boaz. And we see the responsibility fall to Judah's second son, Onan. Onan failed to fulfill his duty and was put to death by God as well. Now, with two sons out of three dead, Judah doesn't want this to happen again. He's realizing that Tamar is the culprit here, not his son's sins. He's thinking that. So he puts into action a scheme by telling Tamar to go back to her father's house and wait for Judah's third son to come of age, right? But he has no intention of marrying his third son to this cursed woman. Instead of taking personal responsibility, instead of caring for his daughter-in-law, he exiles her to widowhood for the rest of her life. The story then moves forward to the time of the sheep shears. Remember back, that was when Jacob decided to leave Laban because this is a time of great celebration, festival with much drunkenness and debauchery. It's in this situation where the newly widowed Judah is encountered with Tamar. Tamar enters the scene with a scheme of her own, verse 13. So she removed her widow's garments from herself, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself. And she sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, that's Judah's third son, and she had not been given him as a wife. So she's got the scandalous plot to trick the one who cast her into perpetual widowhood. She puts on the costume of a cult prostitute, and she solicits Judah to lie with her. Judah lacks sufficient funds to pay for her in the moment, so she expertly leverages his lack of self-control and lust for immediate gratification against him by demanding a high price as a down payment. Verse 18, then he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She said, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. This signet ring was a stamp seal that was like an ID and a credit card all in one. It was worn around his neck like with a cord. She also requested his staff, which was a symbol of his authority, a very prized possession meant only to be passed down as an inheritance for his sons. Realizing how stupid this was, Judah the next day goes to get back his objects, and he can't find her because his daughter-in-law is not a prostitute for an idol. It's his daughter-in-law. So she's hiding, and when it comes to pay up, he can't find her, and he decides not to pursue her, but in order to protect his honor, right? But when word comes to Judah that Tamar is pregnant, he sees a chance to finally be rid of this cursed Canaanite. Verse 24. Now it happened about 3 months later that it was told to Judah, saying, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry." Then Judah said, "Bring her out that she might be burned." He had no guilt about hiring a cult prostitute for himself, but he was eager to burn the woman for acting like a harlot. But on her way to be executed, with what could be her last words, she provides a shocking revelation. She says, I'm pregnant. I'm with child by the man to whom these belong. So she holds up Judah's staff and his signet ring and cords. And Judah comes to this realization, verse 26. Judah recognized him and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. So neither is righteous in this scenario, right? But he recognizes that he's responsible for the injustice, and he publicly acknowledges his guilt. For the first time in this story, Judah takes responsibility. And what we shall see is that this confession on the part of Judah is the first indication of a transformation, right? This dark tale ends with a glimmer of light. She bears twins for Judah, and the account of their birth strikingly parallels the birth of Isaac and Rebekah's twins. The younger brother wrestled with the older, the making out of the sons with the color red, the marking of the sons with color red, and the younger brother receiving the honor. And that younger brother is in the line, not of some scallywag, but of Jesus Christ, right? That's how God's redemption works. He takes this terrible, dark chapter and redeems it. The refinement and redemption of Joseph. I have 15 minutes here. I'm going to hold you 15 minutes late because Sean's done that for the past 3 weeks. Genesis 39, 41 through 57. The refinement and redemption of Joseph. In chapter 39, Moses transports us back to Egypt to the house of Potiphar, who brought Joseph. Now Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian official of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites, who brought him down there. And this is the phrase I wanted you guys to see. Yahweh was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that Yahweh was with him and how Yahweh caused all that he did to succeed in his hand. See how in a foreign land, filled with foreign gods and foreign people who did not know the God of Abraham, the Lord was still with Joseph. God was not only with Joseph, he blessed him. And in Joseph, God was faithful to the covenant he made with Abraham by blessing Joseph's master, Potiphar. Potiphar also sees this reality of Joseph's blessing and causes him to be elevated. And he's the captain of the bodyguard, which can also be translated as chief executioner. It's important for later. However, just when things seem to be going well, we meet Mrs. Potiphar. Verse 7, it happened that after these events with his master's wife, that his master's wife set her eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He's given all that he owns into my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Two things here. Joseph is set up as a parallel to Judah. Think of Judah's uncontrolled lust, and think of Joseph's self-control here. Think of Judah's lack of care for his family, for the covenant of God, and think of Joseph and his conviction that to sin by taking Potiphar's wife would be a sin against God, right? He is submissive not only to his loyal master over him, but ultimately he has resolved to remain faithful and holy unto God, the God who is with him. So we see in verse 11, one day he commands her to, her commands become a lot more forceful. She sexually assaults him by physically seizing his clothing and demanding that he satisfy her lust. And Jacob resists. He flees her presence, leaving his tunic behind. In return for his faithfulness to God and to Potiphar, he's framed for attempted rape. This is about the worst situation Joseph could be in. For Potiphar is the royal chief bodyguard, but also the royal executioner. So who else to execute justice on his wife's attempted rapist than Potiphar? Potiphar responds to his wife's accusation, verse 19. Now it happened when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him saying, this is what your slave did to me. His anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in jail. Now, the text is ambiguous as to whom Potiphar was angry at. And most commentators believe his anger was directed at his wife. And the biggest support for this theory is that the punishment of Joseph was not severe. Rape was a crime punished by immediate execution. Who better to execute him than Potiphar? However, he places him in the king's prison. What's interesting, in the next chapter, verse 3, we see that this prison is in Potiphar's basement. Instead of being killed, Potiphar just demotes Joseph from being upstairs to downstairs. Ruling upstairs to ruling downstairs. And it's even there in the pit of Egypt that we see verse 21, Yahweh was with Joseph and extended loving kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. God was with Joseph there in the prison, showing him steadfast love based on their covenantal relationship. Remember this, that earlier in the story, Joseph received two prophetic dreams from God. He was quite arrogant about them. Now in prison, he again encounters these two prophetic dreams, the dream of the cupbearer and the dream of the baker. And they said to him, "We have had a dream, and there's no one to interpret it." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Recount it to me." In the place of the arrogant dream master, we see Joseph act humbly, pointing to God as the source of his interpretation. Now, these interpretations of these two dreams are comical, and I'll have to skip over them, but just read the irony there. The cupbearer is killed. The baker goes back up top, and the baker, he's like, "Hey, remember me." And the baker doesn't remember him, right? And so Joseph stays in prison for two more years. But in 41, we're presented with two more dreams. This time, it's Pharaoh who's dreaming. And if you remember, the dream's about skinny cows and seven fat cows. And the dream again happens with stalks of grain. And this Pharaoh, who's also in the Egyptian pantheon, a god, can't interpret his own dreams. So he's actually showing here, Moses is demonstrating to the Israelites who just left Egypt how foolish the Egyptian pantheon was. Like, Pharaoh couldn't even interpret his own dreams as the divine Pharaoh. So he calls up the dream master, right? The baker reminds Pharaoh of Joseph. Joseph's called up. Verse 14, we see Pharaoh calling for Joseph. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph. And they rushed him out of the pit, and he shaved himself, changed his clothes. Remember that for Exodus? And it came to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. Yet I've heard it said about you that you hear a dream and that you can interpret it." Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not me. God will answer concerning the welfare of Pharaoh." Notice Joseph again is no longer the arrogant dream master. He humbly declares to Pharaoh that God will answer Pharaoh through Joseph. Joseph has learned who is sovereign and who is supreme. He knows who deserves all the glory. And he's teaching these truths the rule of the world's greatest empire, right? And he gives Pharaoh this interpretation, and he gives Pharaoh this plan that, hey, these seven skinny cows and seven fat cows represent famine, and then blessing. These 7 years of blessing are going to precede these 7 years of famine, and here's what you should do. You should tax your people 20% of all their produce during these 7 years of blessing. And Pharaoh's like, "That's a great idea. I'm going to hire you." And he makes him the second in command of all in the land, right? And in an instant, Joseph was raised up from the bowels of Egypt and seated on the throne as its chief prince, a Hebrew ruler over the largest superpower in the world. God blesses his seed, and he blesses the nations through his seed. Joseph recognizes God's blessing by naming his two sons Manasseh and Ephraim out of worship to God. Notice how the name Ephraim, "For he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." God's blessed him. He recognizes that right away. In this transformation of Joseph's character and Joseph's circumstances, it is so evidently clear that God is the one who's orchestrating it all. Right? God's done it. He's the one who's blessed me. He's the one who's made me forget all my trouble. He alone had the power to transform both the events of history and the hearts of men to bring about his plan and promises. And in verse 57, we say this, "Now all the earth also came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth." Think about this reality. I'm already pointing to Christ here. We'll probably stop here. Joseph goes down to the pit, which later in the Psalms is used to describe death, right? He's raised up out of the pit, seated on the right hand of Pharaoh, right? And he rules over the land, and he causes the land, he takes the land's blessing and causes that blessing to save the entire earth. That's what this phrase, "All the earth came to Egypt to buy grain." All the earth is saved by this one man who was once in a pit, now raised up, right? And in the next chapters, which Pastor Dave will cover next week, we see that all the earth includes Joseph's brothers, right? So we left off chapter 42, and he'll get 42 through 50, and he won't have to rush as much as me. Let's pray. God, you are a glorious God. We see so many wonderful truths from your word here, even when we take a 20,000-foot view. we see that you are present with us and how valuable that is. That not only do you sovereignly care for us and meet all of our needs, that you see us, that you see our suffering, and that you're with us in it. Lord, we know that you are the one who works on men's hearts. You worked on the heart of Esau to cause him to forgive his brother. You worked on the heart of Judah to cause him to take responsibility. You worked on the heart of Joseph to become more humble. Lord, we trust in you to redeem evil for good, because you are that God who has the power to do so. Lord, I praise you. Thank you for your word. Amen.